Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And the theme today, Rabbit, as you told me, is cookbook authors.
Yeah, but more than just cookbook authors. Personalities that are in their own right with fascinating points of view about their particular subject. Yeah. So I'm sure you're going to... This is not just another cookbook. These are some sensible ideas, starting out with preparation for you for the Hanukkah season. Kosher baking is a big thing in the community that celebrates that style of cooking, but the author is a very sensible cook in her own right when it comes to baking. She's a real expert.
Yeah, she's a baker by probably personality and temperament as well.
You might call her a baker's baker, so yes. Here she is.
Paula Scheuer, I took one more look at this new book of yours, The Kosher Baker, and I thought, oh, wow, how much work was all of that, and how beautiful the product.
Thank you very much. I'm very proud of it. I have four children, but I consider this book my fifth baby, and it took about 5 years from beginning to end, but I had been developing dairy-free recipes for several years before I actually started writing the book.
So it had a gestation period slightly longer than an elephant.
Now, this book is applauded by real top people in your field having to do with kosher baking. Joan Nathan,
Oh, yeah. Joan was very Susie sweet Fishbein. About doing an endorsement for me.
Oh, yeah, the endorsements are amazing. I wanted to mention something here, is that it says here that no Jewish kitchen should be without this as a reference book, right?
Yes.
But I think that what's happening is that, because I see at the Fancy Food Show, all the new product categories, even when they have nothing to do with Jewish anything, have kosher approval, and they are listed as kosher. It's part of this whole purity of what we're eating thing.
Yeah, it's an extra layer of evaluation and certification that products go through.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is there are lots and lots of obviously fundamental Jews who are at the Fancy Food Show, and I'm wondering whether they're selling their services to people to kosherize their food or whether they're looking for new kosher options to eat. Maybe it's both.
I think it's definitely both. In October every year, there's a kosher food show in New Jersey that I go to every year, and I will be at this year. And it's really fun to see all the new kosher products from all over the world being displayed there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this book now. I'll talk a lot about this book. First of all, I said to you, a very pretty book. The photographs are so... I don't even have a sweet tooth, and I'm hungry, just drooling over these gorgeous photos.
Photos were done by a local photographer where I live in Bethesda, Maryland, named Michael Bennett Kress, and I had hired him after he'd only done a small amount of food photography, which included photographing Obama's first meal at the Capitol after the swearing-in at the inauguration.
Wow.
So you and when I saw those pictures, I said, those are beautiful. Please come work on my book.
Oh, that's great. Now, you mentioned the D.C. area and the Baltimore area. Tell us, you are owner of a cooking school, a pastry cooking school, right?
Yeah, so I teach classes both out of my home and in the Washington, D.C. area. And for about 5 or 6 years, I've been on what I call the book tour without the book. So I've been going to other locations, Florida, California, Virginia, and teaching cooking classes in kosher cooking, but also French pastry.
And you did study in France.
Yes, I had gone to law school years before, and cooking school in Paris was much more fun than law school in D.C. was.
Do you know how many ex-lawyers we interview? It's amazing.
Maybe it's all those hours sitting at the desk made us all just so hungry.
I don't know, but we have talked to people who've become, they were major criminal trial lawyers who started making chocolate.
He was a funny guy.
Yeah, he was from Maine or Vermont.
No, he was from Oregon.
Oh, goodness.
But he was.
Oh, they make great chocolate there.
But
oh, yeah.
he was.
They make everything good.
I mean, he got these all these threats on his life and all these kinds of things. So he just said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to do something entirely different. So he started making chocolate.
Yeah, people are certainly happier when I hand them a slice of chocolate babka than they ever were when I would write a brief for them.
There you go.
Oh, boy. Let's step back to the organization of the book, because that tells a lot, I think. You said you've organized it as a tutorial, right?
Right, and I wanted to write a book for every kind of baker. So many people like to cook and they're afraid to bake. So many people like to bake, but sometimes they run out of time. Sometimes you're even baking for a crowd and you need to make three or four desserts. So each of them cannot be too time consuming. So I wanted to organize the book with the baker in mind so that there's three main sections in the book, one for every kind of time concern you might have. So let's say you have people coming in 2 hours. You go to the first section of the book, and there's 45 desserts ready for the oven in about 15 minutes or less.
Wow.
And if you're a novice baker, that's where you go. But sometimes you want something more interesting, or you have more time, and then you could tackle the two-step desserts in the second section or the multiple-step desserts in the third section, some of which require chilling or letting dough sit a while before you roll them out.
And then you have an extra section which has... focuses on special Passover desserts and also no sugar added desserts. Is that for diabetes?
You know, if I was going to write a book for the Jewish community, I wanted it to have a dessert for everyone in the community. So if you're baking for a diabetic, you can go to that section. If you're baking for a vegan, go to the index. You'll find vegan desserts. Same thing with gluten-free desserts for those with celiac disease.
That's the fastest growing segment of the food, especially food market.
Yes, I know. I've seen that in the food conferences that I've been to. So I really wanted it to be a book for everyone in the Jewish community. But not just for the Jewish community as well, because there's a large lactose intolerant community in the country as well.
So you've got indexes which point people in the direction of recipes that deal with those kinds of dietary limitations?
Yes.
It has a section on how to use this book. So if you want to use a rabbit, you can do that.
Me, I cook lots of desserts. It's one of my best things. One of the most amazing things, which you know, because growing up, I don't think I thought that my male cousins, there was a tribe of us, knew anything at all about cooking, and we were at dinner at my cousin Michael's house, and he cooked a bomb Alaska for dessert. I didn't even know he knew one end of a spoon from the other.
And I'm happy that, you know, more people are going to get in the kitchen and bake, because I really believe that homemade desserts are so much more healthier than the packaged processed desserts.
They
taste better, and I think when something tastes better, you don't need to eat as much of it to get that buzz.
Yeah, I loved your story about most of your baking experience was from boxes growing up. How funny.
I think it skips a generation. My grandmother was an absolutely spectacular baker.
My mother
liked to cook and wasn't as interested in baking, although my mother just loves chocolate and still to this day pretty much won't eat any dessert I make unless it is chocolate.
Now, who is it who makes the boxes? Duncan Hines is one, and there's another one too.
Yeah, Duncan Hines no longer has kosher certification, the last I checked.
I wasn't thinking of kosher. I was just thinking of cakes that come in boxes.
Oh, people love to, you know, people like to buy cookies and cakes that are packaged. It's so easy.
Here you have the Ten Commandments of Kosher Baking.
Yes.
What do you think? Start at the top, of course, is the parv. No, do you want to explain that?
Yes. Okay. So the reason kosher people need a cookbook on dairy-free desserts is that we're not allowed to combine milk and meat products in the same meal. And what that means is that if we have a meat-based meal, we cannot eat a dairy dessert immediately following that meat meal. We have to wait several hours, which varies depending on one's personal custom.
But you might as well deal with the fact that you're going to have to cook something that doesn't have dairy in it, and that's all there is to it, right?
Well, you know, sometimes I'll make a dairy meal, and then I can eat whatever dessert I want. But so many of our Sabbath meals and our holiday meals are with beef and chicken. That's what people traditionally serve. So you need dairy-free desserts, and you need more choices. Most kosher bakers I know, they've got three or four desserts they make every Friday for Shabbat. They have every single holiday. And I felt that people started to crave more choices and some more interesting choices, too.
So why don't you talk to us about some of those choices, some of the things that you think are the perhaps your most significant contributions to the world of kosher dessert?
Well, one of the things I tried to do in the book is that I tried to have some traditional desserts and then more contemporary desserts, because
okay.
I did want to completely abandon this wonderful tradition of Eastern European baking, which is the basis of so much American baking today. So I wanted to include the rugelach and the bakas and things like that. But I also wanted to move kosher baking forward. Most kosher bakers are serving or selling the same cakes and cookies I've been eating since I was a kid.
Yes, isn't that
so? I wanted to have different versions of them. So I created the babka cupcakes. So it's a traditional babka, but it's made in a different way. I also saw trends in Europe where people combine savory and salty flavors with sweet flavors. So I came up with the salted chocolate caramel tartlets and the rosemary lemon biscotti, and tried to bring some of those traditions to the U.S. and to the kosher community. And I also felt that some of the traditional French desserts, which had been updated even in France, weren't present enough in the kosher community.
Right.
So I wanted to have some of those lovely French layer cakes, like the toasted almond layer cake and the chocolate mousse layer cake.
Yeah, I like the challah beer bread pudding with caramel sauce.
Yeah, that one is great. I guess it was at a time when I wasn't drinking much alcohol, but I was sort of missing the flavor of beer. So I came up with a dessert to satisfy that craving.
Yeah, and then there's the scones au chocolat.
Oh, see, the scones are my personal favorite thing to eat out of the whole book.
Well, and it's the most gorgeous photograph.
The photograph is
I could
great.
Eat it right off the page. It's so
well,
good.
I have to say the photographer wasn't so happy about the melting chocolate, and we had this whole discussion as to whether he wanted to take another slice and take another picture, and I just love that gooey chocolate coming
sure.
out of that slice of scone.
And that's the contemporary style in food. Photography now.
Yeah, there definitely is a trend more to show things sort of real,
yeah.
out of the oven.
Crumbs, that kind of thing.
Didn't know any of those tricks that people use in food photography, that people always ask me, oh, did you use all those great tricks and to make things look shinier and prettier? And I didn't know what those were, so I just baked the desserts and we took the pictures.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, so it's very real. I wanted the desserts to look like what they would look like if they came out of your oven.
Well, that's actually, we just interviewed a food stylist, and that's where we are now with styling. They don't do all the hairspray stuff anymore.
Right. They're just trying to make what's real look even better.
Right. That's
it. And it's a real skill. It definitely is a real skill. I know that, you know, when we were photographing the creme brulee, which was one of the harder desserts to create dairy-free, I sort of wanted the custard to be a little thicker for the photograph, so I ended up scooping into 10 different ramekins to see which one was the thickest looking one that might photograph the best.
What was the trick that you used to make that work?
The creme brulee. So
yeah.
I was having some trouble with that, and I had made it a couple of times, and I'm going to go check it to be absolutely sure, but somebody had suggested to me to put some cornstarch into it.
Uh-huh.
And that's something you wouldn't need if you were making a dairy creme brulee. So I added a half a teaspoon cornstarch into the mixture, and I also added more coffee creamer than I typically would use in my dairy-free recipes. I try to use soy milk
right.
if I can, because it's healthier than the non-dairy creamers. But I needed to use the coffee creamer in the creme brulee to just get a little more of a thicker consistency.
Yeah, well, texture is the same thing that the gluten-free cooks and chefs have a problem with.
Absolutely. Yeah, the flan was the other dessert that was very difficult to get right, and I ended up continually adding more eggs and adding a little whipping cream as well to finally get the texture that I wanted.
Yeah, well, flan would be rather difficult, wouldn't it?
Oh, I think I threw out maybe 6 flans while working on this book, and I really almost gave up and wasn't going to put it in the book. And then I was inspired by a dairy-free flan on Passover that I ate in Jerusalem, and I thought, okay, if they can do this on Passover, I can figure this out.
So you did.
I finally did. I don't know how many more bacon dumps of flan I could have suffered through.
It's no wonder it took you 5 years to write this book.
Well, nobody...
Exactly. That's what happens when you're a scientific baker.
Yeah. I think all bakers have to be scientific, actually.
You do, because when something doesn't come out right, you sit there and think, what was missing? What's the ingredient that's going to make it fluffier, denser, thicker, finer, whatever texture you're trying to achieve.
Well, you've done such a good job on this that nobody else is going to have to go through all of that.
Yeah, it's been really fun over the Jewish holidays to have people come up to me in synagogue and tell me that they made different of the desserts for Rosh Hashanah.
Oh,
and
really?
It's as if I had a secret all along, and now the secret's out. Everybody has my secret.
Well,
but it's making people smile, so that's a good reason to share with the world.
It absolutely is, and I think you've clearly done a wonderful job. Now, this is not just a book for kosher cooks, though, right? I mean,
it's really
a good
dairy-free dessert.
Yeah, so. I keep opening the book and finding other desserts that I love. They really look gorgeous, don't they?
Yeah, one of my friend's sons, who I drive in carpool, who's 10 years old, is baking his way through my book, and I think he's done about 11 recipes already. So when I drive him in the morning, I get a report on what he's working on.
Oh, wow.
Oh, isn't that terrific?
It's wonderful to see kids get in the kitchen. I do a lot of cooking classes for kids, and I have over the years, and I just try to get them into the kitchen to make anything so that they have a closer relationship with food.
Well, this is happening because there are lots and lots of children that I know who are, they watch TV, they know the Food Network chefs, they, you know, they're really into it. Well, it's been a delight talking to you, and I wish you well on this, Paula, and I hope your next book doesn't take 5 years. Do you know what it might be yet?
We'll see. I'm thinking about a book about party desserts and how to, sort of a how-to book on how people can have their own baking parties.
Uh-huh, very good.
So it'll be how to throw your own beautiful dessert buffet with recipes that are not in this book, or other original recipes, and then sort of teach people how to have their own baking party, whether you're doing it for a 3-year-old or an 80-year-old.
Sounds great.
Well, Paula, thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Paula. It was so nice to chat with you both as well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break and eat your cake.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening, of course, to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig, and our next guest, Diana Henry. I think she's just so sensible.
And, she's so very
Anne
British.
Says she's sensible because she's British. I think she's sensible because she has great ideas about how you can make good, sustainable food, and something that's close to my dear wife's heart, how to make leftovers into delicious things. So Diana Henry's book is called Plenty, and as you listen to the interview, you'll understand why.
Diana Henry, you're a very popular food writer in England, based in London. Yes, I mean, I hear that you are, and I've tracked you on
that. I have a lot of good fans, and they're kind of the ones who do follow me, they follow me very, very faithfully.
Well, you have a very common sense approach to cooking. Your current book is what we're talking about, called Plenty, subtitled Good Uncomplicated Food for the Sustainable Kitchen. Now, that's 300 recipes and none of them extravagant. Now, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's funny that you should say I have a kind of common sense approach, because the books I've done previously quite often were about the magic of food, as I thought. The first one I did was called Crazy Water Pickled Lemons, and that book was based in a way on kind of, I grew up in Ireland, and the book was based on me kind of fantasizing about the kind of exotic ingredients that we couldn't get, and I read about in the Arabian Nights. So I'd say that I didn't come to food in the first place through kind of common sense, but I think I was brought up at home in Northern Ireland to be sensible about food and to be caring about produce, about what we ate and how we used it. And it's interesting that as time has gone by, I'm in my mid-40s now, that kind of approach to food, I think even among people of my generation who weren't brought up that way, is you just don't see that very often. And I was starting to read quite a lot about food politics and that kind of thing, especially over fishing. And it seemed to me that it was about time to point out that we had to be more caring without being very didactic about it. I mean, other people have written about this, and I feel quite often when people tell you should buy this and you shouldn't buy that, you feel like saying, you know, I'll do whatever I want. So I wanted to write a book which was about a positive approach to this. It was about do this and you'll feel better, do this and it will make you more happy. And I started to think of the dishes that I cook, which are not very expensive and how you should go about shopping. I kind of started from the point of view of enjoyment rather than from the point of view of politics, which is all about do's and don'ts. So I kind of worked backwards, and I started the book before the current global recession, and I've done a little bit of work on it because we had already started thinking about food a bit differently. I mean, farmers markets, growing your own vegetables is a really big thing now in the UK. And
now, you know, but I remember the time when it wasn't. I mean, I remember we had a niece here who had never seen beetroot that wasn't sliced in a jar.
Well, I grew up with beetroot that way. In fact, because I know that in the US, you all love your beets. And I didn't really discover beetroot as a thing to use as a proper vegetable until I went to Scandinavia about 4 years ago for the first time, because I too was brought up with it in the pickle version.
All right.
Now, the interesting thing, Diana, is that for at least a decade, if not longer, you've actually been able to buy whole beets, already skinned, in the greengrocer shop.
Oh, really?
So they were always there, and we loved beets, so yeah. I used to buy them. I can't imagine my mother would ever have cooked.
I've got my mother into them now, although we didn't grow up with them, except on, you know, that kind of Sunday night salad in the summer, which had a pickled beetroot bleeding all over your kind salad cream.
That would be the kind of
Sunday night cold plate, you know, in Northern Ireland.
And you got to have a little piccalilli, a little violent yellow piccalilli on the corner of your plate.
It looks horrible. But they are delicious, although they have a subtle flavour, actually, beetroot.
Yes, they do.
But I'd say cooking more vegetables is the biggest kind of change in my cooking over the last kind of 7 years or so. I've cooked a lot more, and I think people are cooking a lot more.
Later today, we're going to be interviewing a food writer named Mark Bittman. I don't know if you know him.
Oh, yes. He's the man who does things very quickly, generally, isn't he?
Oh.
He's a quick cook.
He does, but he just came through some health issues, and now he's cooking exactly what you're describing, this way more vegetables, taking the protein off the center of the plate and putting vegetables, so that he has a lot of great recipes. So
you have to kind of not think of meat as the main thing.
Yes.
And when I got divorced about 4 years ago, and my new partner, when we started going out together and he would come round for supper, he'd get in. And it is a man thing. I'd have a wonderful tart with great salad or a lovely homemade soup with a really ripe cheese. And he'd say, well, where's the meat? And it just takes a changing of mindset. You have to kind of get them out of that. And I'd say my children don't think about it too much now at all. They don't really wonder where the protein is. So I think it should still be there, but it's a balance. I'd say we only have meat about 3 times a week, to be honest.
Well, now, I'm like your partner, I think. I'm afraid. I'm guilty, and I think it may have been because when I was growing up, there was meat, but there was never really quite enough to go around. And this other thing about your book that I wanted to mention, because it's one of the more fascinating things about the book, and to me, you should have found a place for it on the cover. There's already so much writing on the cover. And that's how to cook with leftovers, how to create leftovers, and how to cook with leftovers, which is something that my partner in crime survives on. But in my house growing up, there were seconds, and you took your turn having seconds, but there was never anything left over.
Oh, so your mum didn't make things from the previous meal?
Well, there was one exception. We always had a roast dinner at lunchtime on Sunday after we came home from church. And then the cold version of that meat, whatever it was, whether it was lamb or mutton or pork or beef, was served for tea.
Yeah.
The evening meal, usually around 5 o'clock when my father got home from work, and that was Monday. So if you ate too much meat on Sunday, there was less on Monday, and there was an iron hand of discipline required.
I think my mum, and I think this is quite a good thing to do, I think she thought about the leftovers ahead, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So she'd buy, on our Sunday roast, we would have one that was big enough to provide leftovers, because that was a sensible thing to do. You're using the fuel to roast the thing, so you're left with something for next day's meal, and then hopefully with bones for soup and things like that as well.
I tend to do that as well.
I tend to roast on a Sunday a really large chicken, and then I know what I can make with that, or what, you know, that there's stuff left over to do things with on the Monday, and quite often I have to stay in our house on the Tuesday as well. And I almost deliberately create them because I like that kind of cooking as well. We have got very much into the kind of one meal, one dish, one meal kind of culture, and then it's scraped, the leftovers are scraped into the bin, or the foil packaging, heaven help us, is thrown out, and you've had that, you know, you've had your one dish. I think that's why also the style of cooking that we were doing, well, in the 90s and in the kind of from the mid-80s as well, kind of more quick cooking, searing things, flash frying things, all those things required expensive cuts of meat and didn't provide leftovers. So I think it's kind of sensible to think about getting into the way of cooking things which do provide things that you can go on to. And they're not, that kind of cooking I really like because it's not, I mean, I'm a home cook primarily. I'm not a chef. I don't regard myself as a chef.
But now you write a column, don't you?
Sorry?
Do you write a column for the Telegraph?
I do, the Sunday Telegraph, yes.
Right. And so are a lot of these recipes gleaned from your columns?
They're gleaned from there and also from, I just have, if you write about food, and I've been writing about food now for kind of like 11 years, you just have masses of recipes. You're always, it's very unusual for me to be in the kitchen and not have a little notebook where I'll scroll down 2 tablespoons of that or whatever. In fact, sometimes it's a real release that I don't have to do that. So you just build up this huge kind of backlog. I've got thousands of recipes. So some of them came from there. Some of them came from things I'd picked up from elsewhere. Some of them were just things that I thought up specifically for the book. But I think that's what I'm quite good at. If I'm quite good at anything, it's giving people ideas. I think that's what people really lack. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. It wasn't just, oh, hey, we've all got to live better. I just know from friends, from girlfriends, what they find really difficult is thinking, what will I do tonight? What will I do tomorrow night? And that's what I wanted the book to do. Because if you look through the cultures of the world, different kind of food cultures, I think that's what I've done. I've done quite a lot of plundering. There's wonderful home food from every country you can think of. And some of them are particularly cheap as well, but very surprisingly quite exotic. And that's one of the important things to do if you're going to cook with cheaper ingredients or use leftovers. You have to think, this is not necessarily just a kind of down-home, dowdy sort of meal. You have to think, oh, we'll go to Sicily with this, or we'll go to Morocco, or maybe we'll make something that they make in Scandinavia. I mean, Greece, for example, is just wonderful on vegetables, and Italy as well, and Middle Eastern food I cook a lot. And that's, you know, people kind of have tended to think lentils are a trial, not if you cook them the way that, you know, they do in the Lebanon or Iraq or Iran. There's good things to do with all those cheaper ingredients that we're just not really very aware of.
Now, can you take us through a worked example in your book? Let's suppose you're starting off with a roast chicken, like you said you might do on a Sunday. Now, you've got several alternatives then to do with what's left over. Why don't you take us through some examples, starting with your basic roast chicken?
Well, after that's been roasted and kind of mostly eaten, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what the photograph is, by the way, if you don't mind my interrupting. It shows this chicken pretty well devoured almost.
Oh, yes, the one that's... I can still get meat off that, believe you me. I come from a farming background. What I can do with a carcass is quite amazing.
Go ahead, then. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that most people, that when I kind of, because I watch friends doing as well, they take all the white meat off the carcass when it's finished. You have to turn the bird over. And if you look underneath it, there are those bits of meat which you never slice off for anyone, and quite often children don't like because they think they've got a different texture. They're not like the breast meat. But you can get an amazing amount of meat off, you know, if you work hard to get things off it. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, sure, you can.
I grew up with that.
You just tear the chicken apart.
Yes, pretty much. Honestly, as long as you don't have little kind of shards of bone left, it's fine. I kind of like take, and you got to separate the skin. But even in the Pope's nose, that little kind of bit, which is quite fatty, there's a little nugget of meat in there. But my father...
I get that. That's my part.
It's nice, isn't it? And my dad, he really loves, it's another thing people kind of don't know about very much, the oysters of the chicken. And that is on that, you know.
Right.
When you turn it upside down, they're very tender,
it's
and
like, yeah,
velvety. Those
it's
little
like
bits.
Cheeks.
He showed me how to do this, really.
Now, what are some of the options then? So I've got my chicken carcass, and
you've got your meat taken off it.
Okay, go ahead.
You can start to make some stock immediately if you're going to make something like risotto. And I absolutely love idea of chicken and parsley risotto with grated lemon zest in it. And it's a bit like, it's sort of like my form of Jewish chicken soup, because I think it makes you feel so well when you've eaten it, because you've got the stock and you've got rice and you've got little bits of chicken, you've got parsley, so it's quite herby. So I would just, and I could start to make the stock for that risotto as soon as I'd taken the chicken off the carcass, and I might leave it just for kind of an hour and a half if I wanted to make that risotto quite quickly. Or I would make I like quite vibrant flavors, actually, with leftovers, because I think they bring them to life again. There's a Vietnamese incredibly simple chicken and rice dish, and basically you just cook rice in some stock, or you can do it in water, with some chunks of fresh ginger, which you'll take out at the end. Then you fry up some onions or shallots, and you add the chicken to that to warm it through, and add spring onions, and toss it all together, but gently, because your rice, you don't want to compact it. You want it to stay nice and fluffy and with separate grains.
Okay.
So you toss through some spring onions and some mint. And in the meantime, and this is the thing that really brings this to life, there's a Vietnamese dipping sauce. So you just pulverize garlic, 4 garlic cloves, couple of red chilies that you've taken the seeds out of, salt flakes to help those really grind together, lime juice, fish sauce, and then caster sugar, and taste that so you get that balance of hot, sour, salty, sweet, which I so adore, I have to say. And the good thing about this dish, then, is that the children will will either have very little of the sauce, or they'll have none of it at all. For them, it's chicken and rice, and my youngest child is 5 years old. He's not big into chilies, so he'll have it quite, the rice on its own with the chicken quite plain. So the grown-ups will be fighting over the dipping sauce as well. So you just spoon that over, and it looks lovely as well, because suddenly this dish, which is quite beige, but quite lovely for that, is flecked with red and green all over the place. And that is just one of my, when I make that for people, I say, look, this is what, I'm just going to make you something from yesterday's roast chicken, and they look kind of like, a bit...
Oh, you admit it, huh?
Well, yeah, people do expect if you're a food writer to come and you get, you serve really fancy things, and quite often I cook very simple things, but I'll say, yes, this is what, this is from the leftover chicken, making a joke out of it, and then they'll go, oh my, eat it. They will be, delicious.
Now, can you do the same thing with desserts? And let me give you an example of what I grew up with, which was just really awful. This was at my college.
Yeah.
And every Sunday we got a dessert called cabinet pudding.
Okay.
I've heard of it, but I can't think what it's like. What's it like?
It's a combination of all the puddings from during the week. So it's leftovers of every kind of cakey kind of thing you can imagine.
And was it kind of spongy then with dried fruit?
No. What you did then you added some sort of custard. So you made a combination of sort of cake and pudding and custard, and then it was covered with this terrible fruit sauce.
Oh.
But the concept behind it is very interesting, because it's the origin of the name is, you may not remember history, but in 1812, cabinet form of government was really born. The Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, became the Prime Minister, and he said, I'm not very talented, so I'm going to put together a group of people who are the real experts in their different fields. And for the first time, British government had a cabinet, a group of ministers who specialized in different kinds of things. And the concept of cabinet pudding was that it had all the talents. It sure didn't, but I'm sure that you can do something with dessert now. So can we apply this principle of using leftovers to making dessert?
I think you can.
That's a whole lot better than cabinet pudding.
Yes, I think I can definitely do better than that. Well, bread and butter pudding is kind of an obvious thing, because I think there are quite a lot of good British puddings that are very frugal and very sensible. So bread and butter pudding is just, with egg yolks and cream and milk, and that's baked. And I quite often add other fruits to that. And then we've got summer pudding, which is made with bread again that you've soaked in fruit juices, and you line a pudding basin with that and put the stewed fruit in, and then you let it sit overnight and then unmold it. I do an autumn version of that as well, which has dried apples in it as well as the fresh stuff, so there's kind of different textures throughout it, which I think is lovely.
Well, that's great.
I'm a great one for using up. I love to find that I've got fruit that's just slightly too soft to do anything kind of like new with, in a way, too ripe to kind of eat and really be enjoyable. And I do make kind of small pots of jam. I might make a couple of pots at a time, because there's this kind of sense that if you're going to preserve things, you need to get out the pan, you need to get out your jelly bag, and you don't. You just need to kind of a bag of slightly overripe plums, stone them and stew them with some sugar, and get them down to a stage where they're kind of jammy more than just like a puree, and put it in a jam jar and keep it in the fridge. You don't even have to get it up to setting point or anything, because you can just use it now on toast at breakfast or with yogurt or whatever.
Now, you've got some founding principles, you said, that are really sort of woven through the book. Why don't you conclude the interval by just going through those key points?
I think you should think about meals in a, as a flow. I don't think you should think about one meal and then another meal and another meal, which are completely separate. I think when you start to see that there's ways that they can flow into one another, it actually makes cooking and shopping more fun and is pleasurable. I think you need to make expensive ingredients earn their place. So I don't think cooking frugally and sensibly means you never have a roast leg of lamb, but you must think about what you can do with it beyond that, with the leftovers and with the bones. I think you use a balance then of cheaper, like grains and pulses and things like that, and more expensive stuff, so you're balancing that out. I think obviously you should always eat seasonally. I mean, it's mad not to eat what is in season. It's always cheaper and it's also sensible for the planet. And using up gluts is incredibly sensible. I think cooking in the long term is good. Like over the summer I made quite a lot of chutney and jams and stuff like that, and even fruit cordials, and that's been very nice to use gluts up. I think you should eat more vegetables, and I think you basically need to change your attitude to cooking sensibly and frugally, in that you don't think that means suffering. It means you go to other cultures, look at their home food and think, oh, that sounds exotic, and that's just made with lentils and rice and really crisply fried onions with a spicy tomato sauce on the side. You need to go kind of searching for other good home dishes, and I think if you follow those things, I think you'll eat well, you'll eat more happily, and you'll be using the resources we have on the planet better.
Diane, thank you so much for joining us on The Menu. As we said in the preamble to the program, we'll be in London in February. I hope we'll have a chance to get together with you then.
That would be great.
In the meantime, thank you so much for your contribution to On The Menu.
Thank you.
And now another break, with or without cake.
Podcasting services for On The Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and with yet another Diana, this one Diana Kennedy, the grand dame of Mexican cooking.
Also, we should quickly say that she's from my native land, too.
This is true.
Although she moved to Canada in 1953 and then met a husband somewhere in the...
She's had a lot of adventure.
...somewhere in the Caribbean and finished up in Mexico. Go figure that. You'll hear the explanation, and you'll hear all about a lifetime... practically a lifetime of studying Mexican cuisine.
And she's now, like in her late 80s, and hasn't even slowed down a twit.
Diana Kennedy, you've been described as the Julia Child of Mexico. I would probably put it a different way, because you preceded Julia Child anyhow, didn't you?
Oh, no. We were in some ways parallel.
Oh, really?
Yes, she started before I did on that television.
But I mean, I remember being introduced to you through Craig Claiborne at the New York Times.
Oh, yes.
And you were connected to the New York Times through your husband, who is the Times correspondent.
Yes, he was in Mexico and the Caribbean and Central America. And I met him in a revolution in Haiti and then joined him in Mexico, and that is the beginning of this great adventure.
Why were you in Haiti?
Well, I had immigrated to Canada in 1953.
From England?
From England. And then on my way home, because I never traveled in a straight line, I went via the Caribbean through various things, which I will bore you with friends and introductions. And it was to take a banana boat back from Jamaica to England. But in the way, I got waylaid because in the revolution in Haiti, the first journalist I met in one of their many revolutions of the time, or overthrows of government, I met my future husband. So that altered things.
Funny how plans change, isn't it?
I know, yes. It's just serendipity.
They say cherche la femme, but next thing you said was cherche l'homme.
You know, was your background at this point a culinary?
Well, I wonder, some people have read my little book called Nothing Fancy, where it's out of print, but the University of Texas is going to bring it back into print. And that says, but we always cooked at home, and I think that's the secret. You know, you find people who brought up on farms always know how to cook, because they had to. And we had to. My mother taught, and we had homemade food. I don't know how she managed it. There was not much money around. But I saw her making all her pickles and all her pies, and we used to join in and help. We were expected to. So we're expected to cook. It was just part of growing up.
But, you know, this was quite a big adventure for somebody born in rural England, huh?
Yes. Well, it was suburban England, let's say, which is...
Suburban.
Yeah, it was even worse. Well, there was all a sense of adventure, I think, in the family. An aunt of mine went off and lived in Jamaica and married there and was a globetrotter. So I suppose it was in the blood in some ways. And like so many people, England after the war seemed so small for us all. And so many people were going to other parts of the Commonwealth, of course. But I was a bit later in going in 1953. But
you had to certainly adjust your taste buds to deal with Mexican food.
Well, I suppose you do. I found it very exciting. Now, you don't need to laugh about this, but I was brought up with a little bit of Indian food. We always had curries.
Oh, sure.
Because, as I said, it was a part of the Commonwealth, India, a part of the Empire then, I think. And then, so it wasn't surprising to me to have food that was more subtly spiced and rather piquant.
Now, I guess because you were married to a journalist, that gave you the idea of putting your experiences on paper?
It didn't happen until I was rather forced to, I suppose, because it was in our house in Mexico when my husband was alive that Craig Claiborne came to visit, and I offered him a Mexican cookbook, and he said, after lots of conversation, he said, I don't want one until you write one. And so he remembered this, and when we moved back to New York for the last year of Paul's life, then after Paul's death, he invited me to dinner and said, now you have to start teaching Mexican cooking in New York.
Oh, that's great.
So you had spent some decades working on it already?
Well, yeah, 9 years. I'd been in Mexico 9 years.
Okay.
And, yes, and I was fascinated, and I started to collect things, and collect recipes, and work with the cook. So it was the natural thing, I think. And, of course, I love to eat, and I think that it begins right there. You've got to love to eat.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a certain style of research. You actually go and watch native cookers prepare the food?
Yes. And I think that's the only way you can get the real feeling for them. It takes much longer. You're not as productive. I could have done many more books had I done it an easier way. But that's what fascinates me. It's how people live. What do they live on? How do they get their ingredients and all this sort of thing?
Now, did we mention the title of the book?
No, we have not, actually.
Okay,
and it's, I think
good.
We better
let's do
that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Which is Oaxaca al Gusto, An Infinite Gastronomy, its subtitle. What does that mean, an infinite gastronomy?
Because it is infinite. This book encompasses quite a lot, but obviously not everything, and I hope that somebody will go into these regionals. Thing is, within Oaxaca, because of its topography, it has many microclimates, and it's got many cultural groups, so that you do get, in these microclimates, distinctly different chilies and different ingredients. And in different cultural areas, they treat these ingredients in a different way. So it is infinite.
And now, why did you pick Oaxaca?
Well, it chose me. I had always included Oaxacan recipes in my previous book. But one day, an assistant to the then governor of Oaxaca asked me if I would do the book for the state, for the governor. And for various reasons, it never came off. The money disappeared to go to an election or something. But I had begun into even deeper research on that at that time. And, of course, this book has been assembled over many years because some of the journeys up into the Sierras and many disappointments, many rainstorms, many all sorts of things occurred. And so it wasn't an easy book to put together.
It's huge, though, and it's so it's just luscious, absolutely luscious.
Oh, thank you. And many of my photographs, as you will notice.
Yes.
Now, I do want to declare that I insisted on having credit under each photograph because it wasn't fair to the professional photographers, and it wasn't fair to me because they'd never believe I took them anyway. But there are two that have a credit that's incorrect, and for the wonderful photographer, I have to say, you know, there's a magnificent in the valleys, the last section, that beautiful panorama with the agaves and the cultivation, fields of cultivation, that was Michael Calderwood, and we'll have to correct that. And his wonderful woman making the quesillos, or the skeins of cheese, was also his. So that'll be corrected in the next edition. But I cannot claim those for my...
I thought one of the most fascinating things is you also have an attribution under every recipe, which is the cook who actually prepared it for you.
Yes, of course. This is only fair. And, you know, I wish more cooks and young chefs would give at least, inspired by. Because I think it's so unfair that some new and unheard of thing is published under their names. You just have to say that they're inspired by. Because I know it's a nuisance, and it's a nuisance for the copy editors, and editors don't like it, but I think it's only honest.
Now tell us a little bit about how you organized this book.
Well, I realized that each area was quite distinctive in the ways of cooking, or in ingredients, or certainly in chilies, and the ways they're dealt with corn. So it fell naturally into these 11 sections. Oh, yes, I know it's a nuisance for some people who want appetizers, soups.
Right.
And that sort of thing. But it doesn't work in Oaxaca. People don't eat like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to give each region its importance. And then the wonderful... It came out in Spanish first. I did both editions. And it came out in Spanish first. In Monterrey, under the auspices of... Alfonso Romo, who's an impresario there, and his University of Monterrey. And so it was, as I said, first, the way of putting of doing it, where it came out in there first, and when it was going to be done by University of Texas Press, I said, I want the same. This is, to me, makes sense for Oaxaca. And they very kindly let me do it. And I have to also give credit to, I had a wonderful editor for the Spanish edition. She had to clean up my text, of course. The recipes didn't present a problem in Spanish, but, you know, clean up my text. And she's the one who decided that we have to give importance to the three ingredients which are so distinctive and distinctively used in Oaxaca, and that's corn, cacao, and chilies.
I see. And the distinguishing characteristic, is there one overall, or is it just region by region?
Each area has a different way, and each cultural group will have a different way of dealing with those, or different recipes for the chilies, or a different method of using corn, a different type of tortilla, perhaps. And, of course, cacao is so important, and it's... very interesting ways of creating the foam that goes on top of an atole or a corn gruel. And these are very important symbols when you go to eat with a family, a Zapotec family, for instance, when they give you the foam on top of the atole, it is a welcoming thing, and it's... And as one friend, Zapotec cook, who is featured in the book, says, it brings you happiness.
Wow. Now, what level of cooking skill is necessary to be able to cook these recipes?
No, I think skills are not a thing. I will say this. there is, of course, this problem of people saying, oh, I can't get these chilies, I can't get this. No. The U.S. shares a 2,000-mile border with the U.S. You have in your supermarkets, and the upscale ones, exotic ingredients from all over the world. And it just really makes me so annoyed to see that we do not have the more complex and interesting ingredients from Mexico. We should be calling for that. Everybody should be getting on the internet, finding out where those chilies are, because we are giving work to the campesinos, very often in who are living in meager circumstances because of their climatic conditions. Very often, climate's changing so rapidly, and we just have to think that and do this, because other countries aren't represented very well.
Right. Now, I think that Rick Bayless said that he actually hired and taught people to grow some of the more exotic things that he used in his cooking.
No. They'll change in flavor in different climates, but that thing, we have to encourage this, because these are wonderful things. The aromatic herbs in Oaxaca that I use are distinctive and wonderful and healthy.
Right. Well, Rick tells me that even Mexican oregano is totally different, so I'm a total novice with this.
There are many, many oreganos in Mexico.
I see.
There's not just one. There are many. And plants called oregano, yes.
Well, this book is just so authoritative, so authentic, and so luscious. As I said before, Diana Kennedy, I hope Americans dash out in huge numbers to buy it. Called Oaxaca al Gusto, and much success to you.
Thank you very much indeed.
And enjoy your visit and book tour here.
I will. Thank you very
Thank you, Diana. Bye-bye.
And now another commercial break, one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners, and just to show you that On the Menu Radio is a traditional kind of bunch too, we had the opportunity to catch up with the author of the latest edition of a cookbook that's been in print since the 1930s, the Better Homes and Gardens Cookbook, and we were surprised what a living thing this cookbook is. And I think you'll be interested in that, too.
Jan Miller was the food editor on a very important project, the, would you believe, 15th edition of the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook. Now, Jan, I asked you before, how many of us grew up seeing this red and white plaid with the cover with the blue band?
Oh, my gosh. Too many to mention. I mean, I hear stories all the time, really touching stories about women who remember edition from their mother or their grandmother and how special those editions have become to them.
When did it start? When did it come out to start with?
The first book was in 1930, and it was not a red plaid. It was a green-bound book, and it really started as a premium. It was a collection of all the recipes that had been in the magazine.
Okay.
And the plaid didn't come until about the 1940s.
Okay, but we all know the red plaid. It's a huge trademark, right?
Yes, it's just become iconic. And so you can ask people, sometimes they're not quite sure what the title is, but if you say, is there red and white plaid on the
front,
then they know for sure. So.
It's really funny. We used to have what was called oilcloth kitchen table covers, and that was one of the staple colors that they were.
It was. In fact, the editor at the time saw a bolt of fabric in a store, and she...
Oh, so I'm right. That's where it came from.
Purchased fabric and came back and wrapped it around the book cover is how the story goes, and it just has never changed ever since.
So it was her idea just to protect the book so that it wouldn't get wet.
I think you're right. There's some, you think about a warm tablecloth or, something very homey and warm and vibrant about a red and white pattern, and it continues to be. That's something I can safely say we will probably never change.
What I'm curious about, I think, is
actually, Janet, what do you think makes this book have such an enduring traction for how many generations?
I think it is because there's somewhat of an emotional tie to this. So when I talk about the women that will tell you stories about this book, they do have some really warm, fuzzy memories of whether it was meals they prepared for their own family as their family was growing up, or whether it was something they learned from their grandmother or watched their mother make. There's just a very emotional tug with this book, and we find it's a giftable book, and so many women, when they're first married or moving into their first home or maybe, you know, in an apartment on their own for the first time, may be given this book as a gift, and I think that's always something that you remember, too. And I've heard numerous women, even in their 40s, saying that this is a book that they are learning to cook from because they didn't have, you know, skills in the kitchen early on, but this is a book they feel confident and comfortable with to learn.
Yeah, so it's not just nostalgia. I mean, it actually is a very accurate cookbook.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that. It happens to be a really good cookbook, and it's not just recipes. I mean, it's organized around different approaches to cooking. Perhaps you can explain quickly what the organization is, but I noticed in the first few pages of each section there's a primer on what to do. So there's an explanation in the grilling section on what is grilling, what's direct and what's indirect heat and that kind of stuff. So it's an instructional manual. It's not just
a recipe book.
Plaid colored recipe book.
No, we do try to, we feel like it's a complete resource for the kitchen. It's a complete guide. And the very front tab is a cooking basics chapter, and we run through things like, here are the basics that you might want to stock your kitchen with. Here's the scoop on when we talk about beating eggs. This is what they should look like. This is the, different stages. When we measure, we want you to measure your dry ingredients the way that we do so you have success. And so there's several, that kind of information then is scattered throughout the book. And so from the very first chapter that you open, which is appetizers, after that cooking basic section, there's a little ditty on what we feel like are the most important things to know dealing with the subject of appetizers. Same thing with breads and so on. We know that people don't want to read a lot of overwhelming copy and text, so we try to boil down, the very most important things that you should know before you jump into recipes that are in that chapter. So it's very, you're right, we try to teach throughout the book.
And, it's not like just reissuing this thing. You rewrite every recipe just about, don't you?
We do.
What's new in this 15th edition?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many things that are new. We do take it apart every time we revise it and look to see if we are still on trend or if there's a recipe that we just feel like maybe there's better things that have come along the way. For instance, in the bread chapter, the no-knead craze is big, and we did include a no-knead bread.
I'd like to try that sometime. Did you ever try it?
Of course, in every recipe. I got to tell you, we run through the test kitchen, and so that's a big thing in itself. Is we do bring the home economist in who tests the recipe, and then team of editorial people, and we all sit down at a table. So it feels like family style. Sit around the table, and we taste the recipe and discuss the recipe. How did it come together? Are we happy with the flavor? Do we need to change a method? So it really gets a lot of scrutiny before it is deemed worthy to be in this book.
And how much time did it take to get this 15th edition out?
A long time. Let's see. It took us at least a year to get this complete shape. There was some pre-planning probably even prior to that before we started actually testing recipes and taking photographs. So it's a very big project.
And have you always had these full-color photos?
We have always, I will tell you, back in 1930, no, we did not have full-color photos. But yes, for the last several editions we have. But I will tell you, we made them larger in this edition, and then we added a lot more of the step-by-step or how-to photographs because, as I mentioned, some of us don't have as strongest skills in the kitchen, and I like home cook to be able to say, in the middle of this recipe, it's okay that my batter is lumpy. I'm all right at this point. I know it's going to turn out okay. And so we're trying to give people, as much reassurance along the way as we possibly can.
That's a trend, I think, this step-by-step thing, because we've just gotten a couple of other cookbooks with that. One book actually had 12 images for mashed potatoes. I thought that was a bit excessive.
That's a lot for mashed potatoes. But You never know. It just every little bit, I think we're finding every little bit helps, whether it's words to help clarify. Sometimes we change those along the way, too, in terms of how we describe things. If we feel like, that's really not what that looks like, we maybe should change the wording.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, every recipe gets a fresh look, and it needs to measure up in order to make the cut.
Now, are you making a transition to new media? This is a book.
This is a book. You're right.
Is there going to be an accompanying website or a blog or anything like that?
There are discussions taking place probably as we speak.
Okay.
So there are some things on the horizon that I'm probably not at liberty yet to say, but certainly.
Well, look, the Encyclopedia Britannica is going online.
It's either Britannica's content's been online for a long time.
They tried to
charge for it.
But they're going to stop printing hard copies.
Yeah, but here's a difference. Wow. Here's the way that you have this packaged, incidentally, all the way to the ring binding and all that kind of stuff. It's very friendly for someone to work with in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Whereas I suspect that most people would find it inconvenient to actually have their computer open on the kitchen table and pop back and forth to that. There's something about the form factor of a book that is somehow more convenient. I mean, I'm a technologist. I've been a technologist for 45 years. But if I want to read something that's longer than about 2 or 3 pages, I print a copy because I'm not comfortable with it on the screen. And if it's a cookbook that I'm working with, I want to have it open at the pages I'm working on right next to me so that I can keep on reading it and rereading it and rereading it.
Yep.
So I don't forget what I was supposed to do next.
Yep, I totally hear what you're saying, and I'm in your camp, too. There's a younger set of folks who are really used to getting their information digitally, and some of them think we're trying to make sure that we're not leaving out anybody. And if this information needs to be even portable, then more portable than a book in a different format. So I think, like I said,
there's a lot of stuff going on, right?
Yep, we'll see where we land.
All right. I think there's an electronic reader version, there's an iPad version down the road, I feel sure. I just wanted to ask if you had started on it already or whether you were still at the stage you're thinking about.
They're chatting.
Let's get back to, tell us about what's the new features here.
Oh, I'd love to. We have added 3 new features. One is called Make It Mine, and that is a recipe. And we've added a Make It Mine in every chapter of the book. That's a recipe that allows the home cook to mix and match ingredients that really fit the family's flavor preferences or lets her take advantage of items that are in the pantry or the freezer or the refrigerator. For instance, in the pasta chapter, there's a Make It Mine lasagna, and so you choose the meat, you choose the cheese, you choose what type of a sauce, you choose the different type of noodle, a lasagna noodle, and it really allows, and different herbs, so it allows the home cook, you can make it 5 different times and possibly have 5 different recipes. And I love the flexibility that gives the home cook, but I also like that we've done all the testing. So a lot of the combinations we've tried in our test kitchen to make sure that they're going to be okay for you at home. And I think that gives, again, a less experienced cook some confidence in the kitchen when they're working and wanting to play with flavors.
And we also mentioned that you have additional photographs, like lots and lots of them, and they're bigger. And have you dropped any recipe or added something that's just gone out of style altogether? I noticed when the Gourmet Cookbook came out, the revised edition, I checked it against my original Gourmet cookbooks, and I noted the things that were dropped, like my very favorite kidney stew.
Well, shoot. I have to say that there may be some chicken pate recipe that maybe missed the boat this time. But what's interesting, and I was looking back through our first edition of this book, too. I always do once we've got a new edition out. It's fun to see the differences from the very first to the new. But the donuts, there were donuts in the very first book, fried donuts.
Okay.
And those guys have popped in and out of this book several times. In fact, when we did the 14th edition, we took them out because we thought, I'm not sure people are really frying donuts at home right now. We just didn't believe it. So, and now, donuts are back and big.
Yeah, they are
trend.
Back.
And so they're back in this book. So
funny.
There are some things, like I said, that come and go. We try to make sure that we're on trend. And then, again, the classics always have to stay. But we like to make sure that, again, we've tested them to make sure that they are really the best.
Wow. What a daunting challenge is this to keep up to date with a cookbook like this. Jan, I hope you do very well with it. How do people get it?
Certainly, you can buy this book anywhere books are sold, certainly online, your typical sources, but another online source is Wiley.com, and that's spelled Wiley.com.
And there's actually another source called www.onthemenuradio.com.
Yeah, because we have it on our website.
Over to your bookshelf, so it's there.
Thank you so much.
It's there as well for everybody to be able to grab it together with all the other delicious cookbooks that are there.
Great.
So that you can have a collection of cookbooks that's almost as large as the one that On the Menu Radio has.
That would be wonderful. Thanks so much.
We have such efficient bookshelves, we stack them on the floor.
They've taken over the entire hall.
Jen,
thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us,
Jen,
today.
Jen, you've been a delight, and thank you.
You're so welcome.
And there's a secret, but I'll record it on the air. There's a secret to what I'm talking about, but I thank you for your patience before we started the interview.
Not a worry. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Jen, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, listeners, that's all we have for this week. We'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.